Hi, I'm Dan Webster, film critic for Spokane Public Radio.
And I'm Mary Pat Truthart, part-time film critic, full-time vintage American girl.
And I'm Nathan Weinbender, also a film critic for Spokane Public Radio.
And welcome to Movies 101, that show that holds three different definitions of not just the world, but the entire sentiment that rests at the heart of the word America. And that's not just because we differ in ages, in a couple of cases mightily, but more so because we've led lives of far different experiences. That said, each of us has a view of what America is, and all three of us recognize how the country is and always has been defined by the movies it produces. So, following a theme that the New York Times inaugurated a week ago, we thought we'd share the movies that, at least at this point in time, each of us thinks best defines what America has become. Nathan, why don't you start us off?
Okay, so in thinking about my choices of America reflected on film, I wanted to avoid anything that was in that New York Times article. I wanted to avoid stuff that we've maybe talked about on this show before. So I kind of wanted to go a little further afield. So I'll start out with my first choice, which is from 1999, Alexander Payne's film Election, on Tom Parada's novel. And it might be hard to remember, but Payne's early films, especially this and his debut, Citizen Ruth, are pretty blistering satires of middle American values. And as his career went on, he would soften his edges a little bit. But on the surface, Election is a pretty broad comedy about a high school election. But the longer you look at it, the more it's really about the machinations of the American political system, how cults of personality are more powerful than actual policy and strategy. And it stars Matthew Broderick as a high school teacher. His name is Jim McAllister. He oversees the school's election, and he starts to dread the fact that one of his least favorite students, Tracy Flick, I'll never forget that name, played by Reese Witherspoon in maybe her best performance. She's likely going to run for class president unopposed, and he doesn't want to have to work with her because she's a try-hard. And so he throws a wrench into the proceedings by convincing a popular but decidedly not very smart jock, played by Chris Klein, to also run for office. And so McAllister will kind of go on to put his thumb more and more on the scale of the election, and then the movie punishes him in ways that are both very funny and also very humiliating. And the school itself in the movie Election, it looks like just a generic public school in Payne's home state of Nebraska, but it's pretty sleazy and corrupt, just right underneath the surface. You have teachers taking advantage of students. You have the students themselves kind of adopting this mob mentality that values, well, social currency really above all else. And I revisited this movie shortly after the 2016 election, and it was impossible not to see real world parallels in it. And I think what it has to say about America is pretty pointed and accurate and also deeply unflattering.
I have always liked this film, not only for Reese Witherspoon's performance,
amazing,
which is excellent,
yeah,
because she's so sincere and so earnest, and we have all known people.
I think
like
they should
that.
Give her an Academy Award, don't you think?
One day. Well, honestly, she won for Walk the Line, but I think she should have won for this.
I agree.
She's amazing.
I agree. But I think because of the nature of the film, it's being a comedy or dramedy or something.
Yeah.
Maybe she wasn't given appropriate consideration. But yeah, I mean, this captured so many different aspects of American life, not only the high school experience and how it can be, you know, the best of times for some and not so much for, mm-hmm, others, but also just a commentary on the election process,
yeah,
generally. So it seems particularly apt now.
Yeah, I agree. I really liked Election a lot. And as a matter of fact, to a certain extent, it leads right into the two movies that I want to talk about.
Okay.
And I'm going to do both mine back to back, and then we'll come back to both of you in the second half, which will be, I'm sure, much more exciting than what I have to say. At any rate, my first one is Wall Street, 1987. And there have been many movies about the economic system that we Americans live under. Consider Preston Sturges' 1941 comedy drama, Sullivan's Travels, for example. But the field has gotten especially crowded since the financial crash of 2008. Martin Scorsese's 2013 film The Wolf of Wall Street, for example, or Ramin Barani's 2014 feature 99 Homes, or a year later, Adam McKay's The Big Short. None, though, surpass Oliver Stone's 1987 study of capitalism titled simply Wall Street. Charlie Sheen stars as a junior stockbroker who starts out as a man of conscience, but who, through unbridled ambition and his association with the unscrupulous and aptly named Gordon Gekko, played by Michael Douglas, gradually loses himself before finally doing the right thing. The third act melodrama behind all that writer-director Stone gives us pales in comparison to Douglas's riveting, Oscar-winning performance as the charismatic villain Gekko, whose cry of "greed is good" still resonates in the highest political offices of our country.
I still remember some of these performances, and it was eerie. It was scary to me, you know, because of the whole greed aspect of it and the cheering and. You know, it did capture the sort of capitalism run amok that, you know, I mean, capitalism, not necessarily bad. Capitalism as it has morphed, I don't know. I'm a little more skeptical. But yeah, I thought this film was prescient in many ways. And that's why it's a good choice even today.
Yeah, and I don't love Wall Street that much, but I think it's an apt pick despite that. And it's interesting you sort of tied it to The Wolf of Wall Street, because I think both movies are about this unbridled kind of yuppie excess that a lot of viewers saw as endorsement rather right. than criticism, especially that greed is good speech, which is supposed to be chilling, but a lot of people took as gospel. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, I think that's another thing that mm-hmm. you see a lot in these movies we'll be talking about.
I'm surprised you didn't jump on 99 Homes that has that great performance by Michael Shannon.
Well, yeah. I don't really remember that movie so much, but Robert,
he was Gordon Gekko.
But I remember him in it. Yeah.
Right. And I think the 99 Homes is told from the perspective of the repo, you know, kind of people.
Yeah. And Andrew Garfield, who works for Michael Shannon.
Right. And it is actually a commentary on poverty in America, much like Nomadland mm-hmm. or the Florida Project. Mm-hmm. You know, it's talking about what happens in those circumstances when people are living on the edge.
Yeah. Okay. What's your other pick?
My other pick takes us in a completely different direction, but is every bit as riveting. Network, 1976.
Oh, now you're speaking my language.
If, as I said, that our capital economic system has been a popular topic among movie makers, then movies about the media have proven to be every bit as popular. Think of Alan J. Pakula's 1976 film, All the President's Men, or George Clooney's 2005 feature, Good Night and Good Luck, or 10 years later, Tom McCarthy's Spotlight. Hardly all media studies, though, have been complimentary, and chief among the more critical examples is Sidney Lumet's 1976 drama, Network. Working from a script by Padishayevsky, who won an Oscar, Lumet used an all-star cast that included William Holden, Faye Dunaway, and Robert Duvall to capture the inner workings of a television network suffering from low ratings. That is, it does until a news anchor, played by Peter Finch, has a breakdown on camera and behind the support of a ruthlessly ambitious producer played by Dunaway, things change. Dunaway, too, won an Oscar for her performance, as did Finch, but it's Finch's character's cry that captures the perfect feel for what Chayefsky was saying, whether satirical or not, about the power of media. It also reflects how American voters have been acting for the past decade. I'm mad as hell, Finch cries, and I'm not going to take it anymore.
Well, you already know that this is one of my all-time favorite movies. We talked about it when we reviewed the documentary about Faye Dunaway, and I picked it as my favorite performance of hers. And this movie is just, I don't know, it walks such a thin line because it's not subtle at all. In fact, there are times where it feels almost cartoonish and on the nose, and yet somehow it just absolutely works because the form of television that they're satirizing but also just kind of examining, because, I mean, you almost can't satirize this stuff, it also has no subtlety. And so it's on the same wavelength as the media that it's looking at.
Well, and look at today, when we're talking about media today, we talk about online personalities. And, you know, Joe Pyne way back in that day was that kind of a screaming character. But you have InfoWars, you have all these other mm-hmm. online personalities who are every bit, if not worse, than the character Peter Finch plays.
And since we're just throwing out other movies that are related to the picks that we made, I would also say Elia Kazan's A Face in the Crowd.
Yes.
With Andy Griffith as this kind of, you know, what is it, Dusty Rhodes or Long, I can't remember his name, but a guy who becomes this sort of, you know, he's crying out to these people that don't have anybody to represent them in the public sphere. And then it all goes to his head and he becomes basically a fascist in a lot of ways. And so that would be a great but extremely depressing double feature.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that today, when we look at the power of influencers on social media and we actually look at what news has become, because I kept telling people, it's news and entertainment now. I don't care what station you listen to. I still think that there's a huge entertainment function to what we used to look toward for news, and for news.
And that movie network was way ahead of the curve on that.
At any rate, that was the first half of this special edition of Movies 101. As always, right now, it's time to take a short break. Before we go, remember that you can access podcasts of Movies 101 by going online at SpokanePublicRadio.org. While there, check out the individual reviews that Nathan and I write. Don't do it now, though, because we'll be right back to continue our discussion of what we think are the movies that best define America. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
Spokane Public Radio would like to say thank you for your contributions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Whether you're new or renewing, we greatly appreciate your support and listenership. Your support allows us to keep doing our best to bring you quality radio.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you from everyone at SBR.
And we're back. This is Movies 101, and I'm your host, Dan Webster. During the first half of the show, Mary Pat Truthart, Nathan Weinbinder, and I began to run down our personal lists of what movies we think, at least at this very moment, best define America. When we left off, I was talking about my two films, Network and Wall Street. Nathan, you were going to tell us your second movie.
So when I think of America on film, my mind immediately jumps to the 1970s, because that was the era when filmmakers were really grappling with cultural change, but in really uncompromising and confrontational ways that hadn't really been seen before. And I wanted to include a horror film in my selections because I think no other genre captures specific paranoias of a given time quite like horror. So my other choice is 1974's The Texas Chainsaw Massacre, directed by Tobe Hooper, his breakout film. And I don't know if I need to relay the story, and there's not much of one anyway. You know, teenagers are attacked by killers, in this case, Leatherface and his family of cannibals. And even just thinking about the look of this movie, I mean, the Texas locations in this are barren and unforgiving, but also kind of beautiful, which I think, you know, sums up a lot of the American landscape. And this is, I mean, you want to talk about oppressive, unrelenting movies. Very few are as oppressive and unrelenting as Texas Chainsaw. And that tone was directly inspired by just the tenor of America at the time. Tobe Hooper talked about being inspired by news coverage that he had seen that was violent, sensationalistic, going back to Network. Imagery of the Vietnam War being broadcast on television. And even the fact that the movie is pitched as being based on true events when it really wasn't. I mean, that was, Hooper said, a direct response to the American public being lied to by the Nixon administration at the time. And it's also a recession-era film in a lot of ways because industrialism, modernism, technology, they have made poor Leatherface and his family essentially obsolete because this area of Texas was sort of defined by meatpacking and that sort of thing. And so they've turned to murder and cannibalism, and they've made it into a capitalistic venture. That's how they make a living. And that feels distinctly American to me. And as I was reading up on Texas Chainsaw, which, you know, I've seen tons of times over the years, I found a critic named Christopher Sherritt, who wrote about it. And he says that the film gives us, quote, an image of a nation and world careening into total madness while also providing a quick lunatic survey of American history. Hooper's apocalyptic landscape is a desert wasteland of dissolution where once vibrant myth is desiccated. Mm-hmm. Someone had their thesaurus out, obviously. The Texas Chainsaw Massacre is recognizable as a statement about the dead end of American experience. That last sentence, I think, just beautifully captures this movie. And those aren't things that you're necessarily thinking about the first time you watch it. Because it's just pure, unrelenting terror.
Yeah.
But every time you come back to it, you realize, oh, there's something much more going on here than just thrills, you know?
I'm fascinated by people, and there are a growing number of them for a variety of reasons who say, oh, I can't watch anything. I can't watch a film that includes violence. And violence is such an integral part of the human experience. Maybe on the outlier part, but like, let's think of, you know, the Bible, for goodness sakes. I mean, there's now all these, you know, TikToks about people reading from the Bible called like Holy Bible, and they're reading these passages and they're horribly violent. I went to Catholic school for 13 years where there was a representation of a guy subjected to execution bleeding on the front of our classroom.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, when did people think that was appropriate? So I'm fascinated because this, you know, if you're going to eschew violence, and I appreciate people's reasons for it, you're going to miss out on a lot of great movies.
And you know what's funny about that is that Tobe Hooper shot Texas Chainsaw Massacre to be rated PG. So he didn't show any explicit gore, but the suggestion of the violence is such that
it's always worse.
He did not get that PG rating.
When talking about violence, I'm sorry. When that movie first came out, there were no other movies like that.
Yeah.
I mean, none that played in the movie theater, and it was scary.
It is scary.
Compared to what you can find today, it's just minor league. It just, you know, it's a big guy with a mask on with a chainsaw.
Yeah, there's a lot more in Texas
Chainsaw,
so that's why I picked it. I think it's an American, a distinctly American masterpiece.
All right, now let's lead on to Mary Pat, and I think you have not one, not two, but three movies
for us. I know.
Well,
I'm going to begin by saying I initially chose two films that I thought in a sort of serious satirical way or represented America. Bugonia, which we talked about from 2025, and Chinatown, the Roman Polanski 1974 movie, because it does bring in all these features that each of you have talked about in terms of America and the capitalist market economy and so forth. But I just couldn't do it with a straight face. And then I thought, what's the essence of American film? I believe that the LA Times, in contrast to the New York Times, sort of divided it into different eras. And that made sense to me because I think there are movies that speak to different eras.
Sure.
But these movies, I think, are universal. The first one, Borat, Cultural Learnings of America for Make Benefit Glorious Nation of Kazakhstan.
Sure.
Okay, so why choose this movie? Because first of all, I love pranks, number one. And number two, it just seems a parallel. Now, it's a road movie. Road movies, quintessentially American.
Yeah.
And also, all of these people who have come from outside the U.S. for the World Cup, to get their perspectives on the U.S., this is sort of the flip side of that. I also like the fact that this was a controversial film in many ways. Sacha Baron Cohen, I have a love-hate relationship with him. But, you know, I think he got sued like probably 500 times as a result of things that happened in this movie. So that's part of the American experience too, litigation. And I felt as though in many ways, America, we have to have the ability to laugh at ourselves at this point. I mean, that has to be self-deprecating humor has to be part of it. So to continue with my theme, second film, Team America, World Police.
Yeah.
Again, similar theme. Talk about, you know, invading foreign nations. And to me, it just speaks to sort of things that have gone off track. And to my way of thinking, Matt Stone and Trey Parker are the most critical yet right on commentators.
Savagely satirical.
Yes, that's absolutely correct. When I think of some of the things that they have done on South Park, I mean, it bests anything that I've seen, you know, written by intellectuals, written by, you know, commentators, written by pundits. And then finally, the last one, and this did appear on the New York Times list, Idiocracy.
Oh, there we go.
Okay, Mike Judge's film, which really sort of escaped notice back in the day. It's from 2006. And it's a commentary on two people, one who's a librarian clerk for the military and then a sex worker who are subject to hibernation for 500 years. And then they wake up to find out what's happening in the world, in America specifically, during the period of their hibernation.
Directed by Mike Judge, right?
Yeah. Yes. And I think it made like $4 or something. But I think you can't discount the comparisons to the U.S. Over time, and especially now.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's being mentioned everywhere.
Oh, yeah. People use idiocracy now as just a term for describing what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting that the three picks you made are all from around the same time, the mid-2000s,
yeah.
Post-9/11, you know, second term of the Bush
2006,
administration.
Yeah.
Yeah, another
and
great
let's
one.
Give a shout out to one thing. I mean, I talked about these movies that are comedies and satirical, and I think each of you had some aspect of that in the, you know, satire in mm-hmm. some ways. And that's another thing that to me represents America. Free speech, your ability to say things that in other places throughout the world, throughout time, would have gotten you in big trouble. But I do think that that's an important aspect of living in the U.S. And sometimes even I forget that.
And we practice it every week on this show. Though.
Absolutely.
Yes,
especially
do.
Mary Pat does. At any rate, that closes out this special edition of Movies 101. I'm your host, Dan Webster. And earlier in the show, Nathan Weinbinder, Mary Pat Truthart, and I each lists our choices for what we believe are the movies that best define America. Let's take this moment to thank Aaron Weir for directing the show, and we thank you to our loyal listeners. We invite you back next week, same time, same spot on the radio dial, when we'll again check out all the best that cinema has to offer wherever we can find it. Till then, consider these words from the late, great Kurt Vonnegut. So the America I love still exists, if not in the White House, or the Supreme Court, or the Senate, or the House of Representatives, or the media. The America I love still exists at the front desks of our public libraries. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.